First, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a time slot to deliver a presentation today. I'll be talking about some preliminary results that are starting to become less preliminary on predicting trace element bioavailability in contaminated soils. I want to acknowledge my co-authors because some of the data I show you is going to be day-to-day generated. So, and they're significant. It's a big interdisciplinary project, and so at Ohio State, collaborators, University of Missouri, we had collaborators, Tennessee, Knoxville, Oak Ridge National Lab, and the PI of the project is Amy Hawkins, who is at NAFAC, in not too far from here. I want to start with this slide because I actually think this visual sums it up. Total content is a poor predictor for human and ecological receptors. These are 21 uncontaminated soils with lettuce growing on them. The same soils spiked with the same metal concentration, 50 or 2,000 or 250, and you can see what level of arsenic causes toxicity. Well, it really depends what soil you're in. Over here, everything is dead, and over here, there's very little effect. So soil modifies the bioavailability and toxicity. Once you realize this, you start thinking, okay, well, what kind of soil am I on, and how much of this contaminant is going to be bioavailable? And that's important because if it's bioavailable or mobile, it can move from the soil through the food chain, whether that's an ecosystem food web or a human food web. The exposure and the dose, the exposure that's used for the risk calculation depends on the contaminant's bioavailability and its ability to move up the trophic level. So how do we evaluate this bioavailability? If we want to have an accurate risk assessment, we have to evaluate bioavailability. Essentially, the assessment methods are exposure pathway based. So you have to think about which exposure pathway you're interested in assessing the bioavailability. Is it food chain, ingestion of soil, or ecological impact? And there are bioassays for all of these methods. For each one of these exposure pathways that are available once you know the procedure or the pathway you want to evaluate. There are also in vitro methods that are, some of them have been shown to be correlated with the bioassay. For example, weak soil extraction, salt extraction for plants, in vitro simulations for animal models, and different soil extractions have been used for uptake by invertebrates. Bioassay is the best, but it usually is the most costly and takes the most time. So because of that, faster, more inexpensive methods are highly desirable, but these in vitro methods must be predictive to be useful for and predictive of the correct animal plant endpoints. So you can go to the literature and find these relationships. You can find methods that are correlated, procedures that are correlated with the proper uptake or the proper endpoint. For plants, for in vitro methods, and you can find lots of them. They're all empirical models. They're usually developed from a small set of soils. What I mean by that is less than 20 or 30 soils. And every time somebody evaluates one of these methods, we have a different type of correlation because it is empirical. So it's really dependent on the type of soil they select and the form of the contaminant in that soil. So the real question then is, can I take these relationships that are empirically derived and use them to predict bioavailability for new soils at different locations? Can I apply it to a new situation? And that's what I wanted to focus on today. We tried that. We did that. In the project description were 12 soils from DOD or DOE sites. They either had one or more contaminants, meaning, and the contaminants focused on were lead, cadmium, chromium, arsenic. We collected a high volume, we homogenized it, tested it, very large volume, and then distributed this to all of our other researchers to make sure they had the same material. And we used the predictive relationships that were derived from previous studies, including two previous CERTIP studies and an EPA study. We had a wide range in soil properties. So that's really important if you're trying to get a predictive relationship or test a relationship, is that you have a range of different properties. And the test methods we actually looked at were something that are commonly available. We used wet chemical extraction methods that were previously shown to be correlated with contaminant bioavailability to see how good they were to predict. And we also used soil property measurements to see how accurate they could be in predicting bioavailability. Both of these are methods that have gained acceptance. Property is probably the one that has had the least acceptance. Extraction methods have been around for a while. The gastrointestinal method that we used, we actually used a couple gastrointestinal methods, some gastric and some including intestinal. So essentially, they don't assess bioavailability, but they assess how much dissolves in their simulated human gastrointestinal conditions. Okay, so results. We basically took those 12 soils and performed in vitro testing on them, measured the bioaccessibility, and found previous regression equations that were generated, plugged in the IVBA, or the in vitro number, from the 12 soils. Well, actually, in this case, one soil. This was just one soil, because we could only afford one soil with the swine dosing trial for arsenic. It's $25,000 a soil. Actually, we paid $30,000, so you can't get a lot of soils for that. We tried one for arsenic, one for lead, and one for chromium. So we plugged in a number, and basically, this is what was actually measured in the animal. 14% bioaccessibility, range 13 to 15. These models predicted 15, 16, or 12. That's pretty good. So we were very happy with that, but it's just one soil. There's quite a bit of work. People looking at this pathway, basically the relationship between properties and in vitro, this pathway, where people look at the effect of soil properties on in vitro numbers or extractability, but very few people take this extract in vitro number and plug it into those regression equations to see how it predicts in vivo. Well, we did that. So these are three relationships that have been published. Well, one published and one in the works on predicting in vitro arsenic. And for four soils with arsenic, you can see we have a root mean square error as the goodness or the closeness of these values to the actual value. You can see that it's not very good. 36% root square mean error. Anything over about 20 or 25 is really too high. So for across the soils, we weren't getting good fit for the in vitro methods and the ability of these properties to predict in vitro. If we took one of the soils out, which I'm calling soil D, all of a sudden we got very good fits. So the soil properties were able to come very close to bioaccessible arsenic if we took out one soil, which means three soils are behaving one way, one soil is not behaving properly. Or just maybe it's behaving the way it is, right? And we need to figure out what's proper or not, right? So we looked at the problem with soil D was the one we actually had. That was the soil we had the in vivo data on. Okay, you know, so we picked the one that was, so it's interesting. So here's the in vivo data, 14%, and this is the predicted RBA using properties. Not very good, 60%, 56%, way off. If you use in vitro, not very good either. You know, from properties, if you use pH and iron CBD, you don't even come close to what the actual in vitro number is. Okay? So in this case, properties can't predict in vitro well for this soil and or bioavailability. The other three soils, they were close, but this one, it's not. Lead, we looked at the RBLP in vitro method by Drexler and Bratton. There's a regression equation where you can convert your in vitro into RBA. We measured the RBA in the animal. It was 99% bioavailability. The method predicted 83%, which was in the confidence, 90% confidence interval. So it was a good fit. We actually put our in vitro data into that regression equation and got about 100%. So basically, the in vitro methods were pretty accurate for predicting lead. Moving quick to ecological risk assessment, where you're looking at a lot, basically movement of trophic levels. This was a different project. Actually, you just saw some of the explosives work from 1210 by Dr. Cooperman and Chuck Iyer. But we developed it for trace elements. We basically were looking at metals from previous studies. We also used some data from a previous EPA study. We grew lettuce and ryegrass, looked at dry matter and contaminant bioaccumulation. Dr. Lana was on this project, he did earthworm bioassays and looked at these endpoints. And we used prediction models from those previous studies to see how accurate our data, our soil properties, could actually predict bioaccumulation. These are just some of the relationships that we had from our previous studies. We took these data from previous studies. We came up with multiple regressions, relationships between log, grass, tissue, cadmium, and soil properties. We used a technique called a ridge regression, too, that adjusts for the collinearity of intercorrelated properties. This is an issue with soil sometimes because you could have high degree of intercorrelation. And these are R-squares for these multiple regression models. You can see it's pretty good for cadmium. It drops off for arsenic quite a bit, and lead is kind of okay. So we do have some fairly good predictive models for cadmium and lead, and weaker for arsenic. So that this is between properties and what is in the tissue. So now we take our CERT update, or our 12 soils, where we actually have the properties, and we plug the properties into those predictive equation and see how close it can come to the actual measured concentration. So we have predicted by the regression equations and measured. This is a one-to-one line, perfect relationship, all the points would fall in that line, and they're pretty close, except for that one, for lettuce. So basically, you can take properties, plug it into the equation, and get out tissue concentration. I was really surprised how well this was working. For ryegrass, similar. And the correction at ridge regression really didn't have as great of an effect as we thought it would have in this data set. For cadmium, for ryegrass, excellent. You put in properties and outcomes, you're predicted. Cadmium, not as, for lettuce, we still have this ugly point up here. And we have a few soils that are not, but the rest of them are fairly good. You never get perfection with these things. This was just a quick and dirty graph I made before we do some more analysis on this, but I did want to show you calcium nitrate extractable, a neutral salt extraction, 0.1 molar. And this is showing the white, the open circles, the white circles are from previous work, NCEA work. And the black filled circles are the study soils. We wanted to see how well it fit. And you can see it meshes in. Essentially, you're getting the same type of relationship. And so calcium nitrate is actually doing a fairly good job of predicting lettuce lead BCF here and ryegrass lead BCF. In earthworm tissue, I'll just show you one graph with earthworm. This is looking at pore water, well, beyond pore water, 0.1 molar calcium nitrate extractable and earthworm tissue lead. Most of the absorption is dermal through the earthworm, and you can see it's trying to work. I mean, the black points are the actual prediction. But, you know, this is basically taking data, extraction data, and plugging into relationships from completely different studies that were on different sets of soils. So it's pretty close. So in summary, the in vitro methods, I think, just for the limited number of soils we had, were pretty accurate for lead and arsenic. Now, it's one soil. We need more. And we're going to be expanding this to more than one soil. Soil properties really weren't very good for that one soil for arsenic bioavailability, or it was way off. The bioavailability is 14%, and the properties are 60% prediction. And that one soil, by the way, you really have to dig into the bottom comment here, the contaminant speciation, because that was the difference between the three that agreed and the one that didn't. It makes sense when you look at the speciation. The speciation should be similar to the regressions that were used in the predictive relationships. So if it was a regression that was predicted using mining waste, it's good for mining waste, maybe. if it was predicted using soils that had lower levels of introduced chemicals, then you should be using a predictive relationship from that. But we did see pretty good ability to predict lead and cadmium in tissues for most soils. There's some promise for extraction methods. Okay, so this is very, very new. I guess the bottom conclusion is we're surprised how well some of these things worked for predicting, and more has to be done on this and has to be expanded. Future directions, development and application of new methods to measure bioavailability. What everybody really wants is this. That's not coming till the 23rd century. And so, but in the meantime, you could actually buy a smartphone that looks like a tricorder, right? So we're heading that direction. But people really want to be able to have an exact measurement of bioavailability by some advanced technology. And I think some of the older technologies are working pretty good, but advances are coming, including in situ contaminant speciation methods. Development acceptance of risk-based frameworks are needed, and they're becoming available, actually becoming more available and faster available in the EU, Canada, and Australia than they are in the States. But in the States, we're actually, after many years of this, it's starting to get acceptance. I'd like to acknowledge our funding sources, by which without this, none of this would be possible. ESTCP is the actual funding study, and the previous studies were CERTIP studies that provided us the predictive relationships. And with that, I would like to entertain your questions.
Nick, thank you very much for a very good summary and talk. We have time for one, two questions, and then we will have break and we'll continue at this session. Starting 10:30.
All the way in the back.
How many tests of soil did you use in your model, and how many samples for each soil?
How many samples? The predictive models, the original ones that we made, the original studies had 21 soil types at one study. The other one, it was 5 soils. At a range of different metal concentrations. So total number of soils would be 26 for the predictive. And then we were using 12 soils in the ecological to test that. And with the in vivo, it was much more limited for ingestion. I think the important thing is we're working another project here now looking at a range of contaminant species. I mean, basically, you have to make sure you have a range in soil properties, and a lot of these studies do not have that range, and so it's not robust enough. So if you try to predict bioavailability with a different contaminant source or outside of the range that was tested for some properties, you may not get a very good answer. So what we really should be doing is restricting the use of these equations to previous forms that were tested and ranges of properties are tested. Yes, George.
Nick, thanks for a great presentation. Yeah. Particularly on the calcium nitrate data that you showed, were those regressions developed after appropriate speciation of the particular metal?
You mean the activity of cadmium or something like this in solution? No, they weren't on activity. These are totally dissolved. Correct. Right. 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 Well, in these soils, we really didn't have much. I mean, we didn't have the humic material. We didn't have the high salt content, meaning we didn't have the high chlorate or something along these lines. So we could speciate it, but we'd expect under those conditions that the total concentration be similar to the activity. Yes. Well, these are not heavily contaminated soils, and they do not, I mean, these are not smelter soils we're dealing with. We're dealing with low-level contamination. They're not, the chloride concentrations are low. The organic matter concentrations are fairly low, so.
So soil D, the one that?
Soils, soil D are, was tailings on a site.
Yeah. Okay.
And so it's interesting because the properties had virtually no effect on it, because really the solubility was being driven by the properties of the waste more than the soil.
Which could very well affect the speciation as well.
Yes.
But your calcium nitrate extract is a constant ionic strength extract anyway, so even if you speciated that, it's going to come out linearly related to the activity.
It's, yeah, the ionic strength is considered, but if we used, if there was a high chloride or sulfate content in the waste material, you could come up with ion pairs or complexes, even at the same ionic strength.
Nick, I have one question. Yeah. When you're developing the models, that work was out of the CERTA program and for EcoSSL development. EcoSSLs are developed only for upland aerobic soils within certain parameters. Was your model developed using that type of constraint then? That they were all upland
Yes.
aerobic soils?
Yes, they're all upland aerobic soils, and they were all within those reasonable parameters of soil. You know, so we didn't have anything extremely acidic. We didn't have anything that was extremely basic. We stayed within those parameters, those normal parameters for the EcoSSL.
Thank you.